Both Jack Kemp and Al Gore were presidential candidates before they were vice presidential candidates. Both men ran for their party's nominations in 1988 but got little support from voters. Jack Kemp thought his presidential ambitions were over, then Bob Dole asked him to be his running mate. Gore passed up a chance to try for the presidency in 1992, only to join Bill Clinton on the Democratic ticket. Now these two men are crisscrossing the country with relatively little fanfare in what is widely viewed as a national dress rehearsal for the presidential race in 2000. 2 weeks ago, we took a look at the candidacy of Jack Kemp. Tonight, NPR's Nina Totenberg has a profile of vice presidential candidate Al Gore.
By all accounts, the Clinton-Gore match has been enormously successful. The two men have become such close friends and confidants that the vice president is widely regarded as the president's most influential advisor, except for the first lady. Clinton has given Gore a wide variety of important domestic and foreign assignments, from heading the task force on reinventing government to negotiating with leaders of the former Soviet Union about the destruction of nuclear weapons. In this administration, the vice president doesn't do funerals. He's a valued partner. Few Washington insiders doubt Gore's brains and ability. But in order to be a successful candidate and leader in the modern media age, more than that is needed. And in 1988, Gore earned a reputation as a wooden speaker who provoked more sleep than spleen and little electoral enthusiasm. Just listen to him at a debate in New Hampshire back in 1988.
The Reagan administration, Federal Communications Commission, and Justice Department has instituted a new program of, in effect, taxing local users, including low-income users of telephone service, in order to subsidize competition for long-distance service, which is dominated by large commercial users. They call it
access. Now contrast that with this speech earlier this month at Chicago's Apostolic Church of God, the largest African-American church in Illinois. There, Gore spoke about the book of Ezekiel, in which God turned dried bones into a living
army. God breathed life into those dry bones, as we should breathe life into communities that have been afflicted, that have been damaged, that have been hurt, churches that have been burned, lives that have been ruined, young people that have been denied opportunity, communities that have been ravaged by crime and drugs. We're called upon to lift them up from the side of the road, to breathe life into God's people, to do what we can, to stand in the fire with them, to stand against hatred and prejudice and persecution. And with your help, we will do that in the United States of America. Praise God. Thank you for letting me be here today.
Now, you may ask, what happened? What did he eat for breakfast? The answer is something non-fattening and simple. Al Gore is the ultimate disciplined man. And over the last 8 years, he has taught himself to be a much better candidate than he was in 1988 or even 1992. One of his tools of the trade is self-deprecation. At every stop, he reminds audiences of his motionless rendition of the Macarena at the Democratic Convention, and he never fails to tell a few stiff jokes on himself, as he did in Rapid City.
Did anybody see my debate with Jack Kemp? After that debate, one of the commentators had the audacity to say Vice President Gore finally distinguished himself from the wooden podium in front of him.
And Los Angeles.
If you use a strobe light, it looks like Al Gore is moving.
And Reno.
How can you tell Al Gore from a room full of Secret Service agents? He's the stiff one.
And Chicago.
Every time I hear a new one of those jokes, I almost always have the same reaction. Very funny, Tipper.
The fact is, it's not so much the actual jokes that are so entertaining in Gore's stump speech. It's his sardonic sense of humor, woven in to make a point. As he describes it, for instance, he and Bill Clinton came to the White House with a plan for change, a plan to bring down the deficit while investing in education. But Bob Dole and the Republicans were the villains who obstinately stood in the way, and not a single Republican voted for the Clinton budget plan. In the end, it passed the House by one vote, and in the Senate,
it was a 50-50 tie, causing momentary despair.
But as Gore notes, the Constitution has a solution for such situations.
Students at the University of Nevada, Reno know your Constitution. There is indeed a little used provision that is nonetheless extremely significant. Translated, it says, every time I vote, we win. I voted and we won, and change came to Nevada.
Of course, you can't take the robo-candidate tendencies completely out of Al Gore. They seem to crop up most often when he's nervous, as in his debate with Jack Kemp, where he clearly won on points, but stylistically lapsed back into some old robotic habits, chanting the same phrases like a mantra over and over again, that the Republicans had a risky scheme that would blow a hole in the deficit. In an interview, I asked Gore about that.
Well, you remember it, though, don't you? But let me answer your question in a different way. In a debate setting like that, you have so much to remember, the strategy, the message, the different responses to whatever your debate opponent might bring up.
The strategy, says Gore, was to make Jack Kemp confront his longtime differences with Dole on everything from economics to immigration.
And so I wanted to highlight and identify some of the most basic disagreements early on in the debate to see whether or not Jack would defend his former positions or just say nothing. I thought that if he said nothing about it, that it would maybe throw him off stride a little bit and knock him off his game a little bit.
And what, after 4 years in the White House, is the most important thing he's learned from Bill Clinton? The answer is revealing. It's the importance of empathy in a leader.
It is not, as some people try to lampoon it, just, you know, desire to seek approval or to get the most number of people to feel good about him. It is an effort to really discern what this nation of ours is most in need of.
Great, thank you. Tell your family hello.
I will, thank you.
You can see that lesson in Gore's eyes now as he works a crowd after a speech. 4 years ago, he would politely shake everyone's hand along a rope line and then turn to leave. But he's watched how Bill Clinton does it, almost literally throwing himself into a crowd with joy, a Secret Service agent, often holding the president around the waist so he won't be carried away. Al Gore doesn't do that, of course, but he isn't an awkward, stiff guy either. Now he reaches for the crowds, leans into them, he grins and shouts encouragement and tousles a little boy's hair. But if you look carefully at Gore's eyes, there's no doubt he's at work. In private afterwards, on Air Force Two, he finally takes off his jacket to relax with his daughter Karenna, who's traveling with him. He wanders back to the press section and referees a poker dispute, causing momentary despair, to one side. He likes to tease and be teased, up to a point. On the plane, I asked him whether, if he and the president win re-election, he will actually do the Macarena at the inaugural.
Well, I'm not sure you're looking closely enough at my version. It has very subtle movements that very few people can handle in just the right way. Now, I am practicing.
How about if you're elected in 2000 on your own, will you actually move your hips then?
I'm focused on 96.
Ever the cautious politician, Al Gore isn't talking publicly about the year 2000. But he is planning and preparing himself. He's lining up delegates, thinking about strategy, pondering the Dick Gebhardts and Bill Bradleys who may well run against him in the primaries. And he is undoubtedly praying that the economy doesn't go south, just as his moment finally arrives. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.